The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
Today on Getting to Yes And, my guest is Christy Heffner. Christy serves as the chairman of Hatch Beauty, a brand and product innovation company. She was executive chairman of Canyon Ranch Enterprises, and she was the chairman and CEO of Playboy Enterprises for 20 years, making her the longest-serving female chairman and CEO of a U.S. public company. She has also served as director for the Center of American Progress, a think tank started and run by John Podesta. She has been named to Fortune's list of most powerful women multiple times and has spoken audiences around the world on brands, marketing, leadership, and First Amendment rights. Christy, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So our group at Second City Works has been doing a lot of thinking around gender and diversity in the workplace. And one of the popular ideas that keeps popping up in our research is the idea that women in particular need to change their vocabulary. Specifically, women need to avoid saying things like, sorry, I just, I was wondering, I think. So you've been a woman in leadership across generations, and I'm so curious if you subscribe to the need for a vocabulary change.
Well, I tend to not like gender generalizations.
Yep.
Because I've been around enough leaders. I was the first woman in the Chicago chapter of Young Presidents Organization. I was a founder of both the Chicago Network and the Committee of 200 and the Chicago Chapter of Women Corporate Directors. I have seen too much diversity among women and among men to ever put a stake in the ground the way some people do. Having said that, I do think that anybody, and it could very well be that statistically it's more common for women, who default mode is self-deprecating and less self-confident and more apologetic would benefit from developing a style and a vocabulary that projects not arrogance and certainly not a sense of inability to participate in a collaborative way, but confidence in the views being expressed.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense, right? And I think so where we've sort of are moving our work in this area is that if there's a diversity and inclusion problem, which I think there is, it's everybody's problem. And I think to that point, it's a people problem. It's a human problem. And you're right. I mean, we all carry these traits inside of us. And we talk a lot about sort of soft skills and hard skills. And certainly, I think Second City and improvisation is a soft skills issue primarily. But I think that sometimes it gets lost in the translation when we start to divide. And what we want to do is get everyone in on the conversation.
Well, and another way of putting exactly that point is that to be an effective leader, in my opinion, requires having a lot of tools in your toolbox.
Yeah.
And some of them might be considered tools that are more traditionally stereotypically female, that are around collaboration and nurturing. And some of them might be considered more traditionally stereotypical male,
right,
being tough, being aggressive, being results oriented. In truth, we have, all of us, those qualities within us. And just as I would think in improvisational theater, and certainly in theater, which I did a little of in my misspent youth, you want as big a toolbox as you can bring to your performance. You want as big a toolbox as you can bring to your role as a leader, because each situation, both in terms of who you're working with and the demands of that moment, may require a different set of skills.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at Stanford this week at the Graduate School of Business, working in a class and team teaching. And one of the things that came up what we don't understand is why people check their humanness at the door when they enter a business. And this seems common, that they don't want to use all the things that make them interesting and full people. Empathy, that has a place in business.
I would say it has a huge place in business. In fact, I'd argue it's pretty difficult to be really successful without
right.
that gene. I don't know. I don't know if it's that the business people that we've historically looked up to and lionized, we were somewhat reductionist in how, you know, we understood them, how they presented themselves to the media. So
yeah, they were advertised to us as this
yeah,
other.
Yeah, there's a yeah. sense that they didn't have those qualities.
Right.
And that was, I think, especially true 20, 30 years ago when they were all male and mostly all white male.
Right.
And so, especially if you were the other, whatever that meant, a woman, an openly gay person, an African American,
right.
you're going to try to pattern yourself after what you perceive to be the success,
mm-hmm.
and you're not going to color outside the lines. So
right.
that may have contributed to it, but I completely agree with you. I think that the people who are able to inspire and to lead and to create an environment in which talented people do their best work need to be willing to show and invest their humanity.
Right. Be a little bit others focused, attempt
mm-hmm.
to connect.
Very much so.
Yeah. I'm curious too. Okay, thinking about you as a person, I just think of these three different brands as being very different: Playboy, Hatch Beauty, and Canyon. Right. So health and wellness, and then male and sort of female related. Right. They. So I'm curious, being a leader of these three very distinctive brands, how do you change when you enter each of those boardrooms, or do you not?
That's a good question. I think it's a mix.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, to use a much overused word, but that doesn't mean it's a bad word, you know, to be your authentic self
sure.
means to be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And you could talk to people from every part of my life and you could throw in my board work at CAP or the ACLU or
right.
Rush, people who only know me in one setting. And I would venture to say that there would be definite common themes and adjectives and sentences that people would use to describe me. And that's who I am in all situations.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you're not able to read the room,
yep.
if you're not able to sense whether on a scale of formal to informal, on a scale of people who are comfortable being challenged versus people who are not so comfortable being challenged. Whatever those individual dynamics are in a situation, which is the same when you're leading a company or sitting in a boardroom, then you're, I would say, at the very least, limited in where you can be successful, and I would argue maybe even limited in your ability to be successful anywhere.
Sure. I mean, because I think the other thing that happens, I mean, certainly happened with me at Second City, is you begin to personify the brand. There are brand attributes that just make sense to you, that you agree with. Other aspects that don't, right? Because we can't be all things to all people. I think that's also a huge mistake that leadership can sometimes venture down. So I wonder, when you went to Canyon, for example, right, this health and wellness, sort of, was that something that you were passionate about at the time, that you knew a lot about?
Well, I had served on the Canyon Ranch board during the time that I was CEO of Playboy.
Okay.
So I served on a number of other for-profit boards,
right.
one at a time, because I thought it actually made me a more effective CEO.
Sure.
And because it broadened my perspective on the world and business and resources. So the founders knew me,
mm-hmm.
and when I left running Playboy, reached out to me with the hope that I could help them think about their brand and certain content that they had, but had never considered content the way you and I would think of content, because they thought of it as what happens when a guest comes to the property. They
sure.
go to a consultation, they go to a program, they go to a lecture. And what they wanted me to help them do is to develop the strategies and put the resources together that could extend the brand and content in furtherance of their mission, which is to give people the tools and inspiration to lead healthier lives. So I knew a little bit about health and wellness because I had been on their board. Mm-hmm. I would say it was a part of how I've lived my life, not necessarily a passion.
Right.
I do value brands, and I did feel that in many ways, like Playboy, they had created not just a concept, but a category before anything like that existed, because they were over 30 years old when I joined them. And
that
was way before
people
talked about health and wellness.
And mindfulness.
Mindfulness, and all of that. So it met one of the things that in this portfolio chapter of my life has been a requirement as to whether I do something or not, which is, do I believe that I can add value? At the same time, do I believe that I will learn something new from it?
And, I mean, just like Playboy, right? Cutting edge, rooted stuff when no one else was doing it.
Yes. And founder, still founder driven, which I had some experience with.
All right. So I have a working theory I want to test out on you.
Okay.
And if it's bogus, you can call me out and it's fine because we can edit that out later. And I can just say, yes, I agree with you, Kelly. I have this theory about Chicago's creative culture. And my theory is this. I believe that if you look at our creative history in the city, that we've built a creative culture based on process and practice rather than ownership, which I think is very different than the coasts. And I think what that does is allow us to be steady innovators because there is not the intrusion of ownership, managers, agents. And you see this certainly in improvisation, which doesn't really have an owner, ensemble-based theater, which everyone sort of collectively belongs to, house music, which is borrowed. And the other thing about not owning is the talent leaves, which in most places would be crazy. But in here, it allows for the next talent to come up and create creative space. And I think when you look at the fact that Second City and Playboy sprouted in the 1950s, Playboy earlier 50s, but still I think but the fact that Second City was 59 means it wasn't the 60s,
right?
You know, when different things were going on, that there is something unique happening in Chicago at that time where a lot of this stuff started to occur.
I'm inclined to think that you're onto something.
Okay.
Because I think that there is fertile ground here that is different than the coasts for creativity, entrepreneurship, innovation. I think it's a less judgmental place.
Yeah.
I think it's a more nurturing, supportive place. I hadn't thought about your point with regard to process versus ownership, but I think that that idea, which you could say was behind the Imagists,
know,
and maybe blues, and other things that we could think of as being born in Chicago that were and remain, you know, kind of cultural touchstones. So,
and that Playboy was a champion of artists and ideas, right?
And it was, very much so, of jazz and blues, of...
Well, and the early Second City guys, they were always over. I mean, the Playboy After Dark, those guys are in the background half the time.
In fact, although I didn't know him in those days, Harold Ramis, who was quite a good friend, first would say early in his career, kind of had an important milestone when he was hired to be the party jokes editor for Playboy magazine.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And what a generous spirit Harold was, right? You know, a lot of times when I get hired to talk on leadership, I talk about Harold because...
good role model.
Totally. And it was such a great mix of skill, expertise, good humor, generous, so generous. When I was a dishwasher at Second City, he treated me the same as a producer, and I'll never forget that. And brought with him, you know, such terrific instincts. One of my favorite things that he ever said as a piece of advice was find the smartest, funniest person in the room and stand next to them. And for him, that was
It'll
John Belushi.
It'll certainly enhance the cocktail party.
Yeah exactly. But it's totally great advice, right? Like, oh yeah, find someone great, go sit next to them. That's what's going to happen. I'm curious too about, because you've been active in First Amendment right advocacy. Did that come about because of working for Playboy, or is that something before?
That was before.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I was interested in politics.
Oh, and law too, right?
Yeah, going way back. I mean, I wrote a letter to the editor that got published when I was in high school against the death penalty.
Wow.
My mother was very politically active and was almost always a poll judge in Wilmette. Of course, she was on a short list of Democrats who lived in Wilmette at the time.
Did you grow up in Wilmette?
I was born on the south side of Chicago, and then we moved to the north side. And then when my mother remarried in 59, we moved to Wilmette. So I went to junior high school and high school in
New
Wilmette.
Jersey?
Yeah.
Yeah, so did I.
West.
Oh, you were West?
Yeah.
I was there when they combined.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I went door to door canvassing for candidates with my mother way before I was old enough to vote, and was just always interested, you know, as many people of my generation were. You know, I helped to put out an alternative newspaper at New Trier to oppose the war. And, you know, it was a time of, I think, a strong awakening around an interest in politics because of the war and because of what was happening in Washington. And when I was at Brandeis, I actually thought I would try and go to Yale's Graduate School of Law and Public Policy, and then my dream was someday to wind up in the Senate or the Supreme Court. So all of that preceded Playboy.
That's interesting. So you're at Brandeis during the Kennedy election, or right after?
At Brandeis from 70 to 74.
Oh, it's a little later than that. Oh, very different. So you're at Brandeis as Watergate, and
yes,
wow, that's an interesting time to be in college.
The bombing of Cambodia and all of that.
Were you an activist at that point?
I was. I wasn't a marcher, but I worked for candidates.
Yeah.
Father Drinan, Michael Harrington.
Sure.
I taught in Upward Bound.
Mm-hmm.
So I did things like that. And I liked very much being at a university. It was one of the appeals to me at Brandeis that had a strong social conscience and a strong interest in social justice.
I read somewhere that you said that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has your dream job.
I don't think I said that, but I'm an author.
Someone said you did.
And I do have a letter from Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Do you?
Because when she got named to the court, I wrote her because the Playboy Foundation gave the seed money to start the Women's Rights Project of the National ACLU, and she was the first executive director of it. And when she got put on the court, I wrote her an unapologetic fan letter that I just thought it made my heart sing that she was now going to be on the Supreme Court, and that I doubted that she remembered, but that, you know, we had had this intersection of our lives long ago. And to my surprise and delight, she wrote me back a personal letter. She said absolutely she remembered.
Oh,
that's
awesome.
It made all the difference in the world, and couldn't have been more gracious.
Oh, that's I met her once. My ex-wife was friends with her daughter, and then when she got named to court, I'm like, this is I actually met a Supreme Court justice, and I find that whole world fascinating.
Yeah, me
I mean,
too.
You know, and I even enjoy, you know, all the when Scalia passed away, I really enjoyed reading about his wit. And how that was so, because I don't agree with him politically, like on anything.
Right.
But the two of them
were quite close.
They were quite close. And I bet we'd love having a conversation with him. I wish I had the chance to have a conversation.
I just actually had a drink the other night with a friend of mine who runs the Constitution Center, Jeffrey Rosen, who's just finished a book that's been very well reviewed. And he gave me a copy. I haven't started it yet, which is on Justice Brandeis.
Okay.
Which I'm looking forward to.
Oh, yeah. All right. So speaking of this, too,
okay.
I found a little quote from you that I want you to explain because I think it's pretty cool. You said, intellectual agility, not intelligence, is the most valuable quality.
I did say that.
Yeah. All right,
good. I do believe that.
Yeah. Tell me more about that. What does that mean?
Well, I came to appreciate that when I was still running Playboy and was frequently in a position of having to choose who to hire or promote into senior jobs. And early in my career, my assumption was, you know, you look for the strongest resume. You know, if you want to hire someone to do A, B, C, D, E, find someone who's done A, B, C, D, E, and then hire that person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to believe that that was a much too limiting way of looking at talent and potential. Mm-hmm. This is one of the problems about the gender gap in executive ranks is that we know from the research that men get promoted on potential and women on accomplishments, and women are not helping themselves because they tend not to apply for jobs where they don't have a very high percentage of the requirements that they've already done in their previous job. Whereas men, I think the average is like 40% and 90%. Men see 40% match and think, well, I can do the remaining 60%. But anyway, I then moved to this idea of, no, what you really want is just really smart people. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you hire really smart people, then they'll be successful. And then especially because one of the opportunities I had in the years I was CEO of Playboy was to really reinvent the answer to the question, what business are we in, away from a magazine company to a brand-driven multimedia and lifestyle company. And that reinvention puts front and center the need to have people who are capable of constantly asking, why not, or why, or what businesses are we in? And that is, to me, what intellectual agility is. It's the ability to learn new things, to think different ways, to never become a captive of what you have done before or what you think your job is. And especially at the rate of change in today's world, I think the people who will be most successful will be the people that have cultivated that ability, because people are going to have so many different types of jobs and careers, never mind the whole concept of the gig economy where you don't really have a job or a career at all.
Right.
And I really do deeply believe that that is the single most valuable skill.
So what I love about what you're saying is as a leader, calling out the fact that your position changes, your ideas change, right? And the worst insult you can have in politics is to call someone a flip-flopper.
Right.
And there's a ridiculous aspect to that, which is curious minds evolve and they change and they should. That's actually a really important thing. Now, I get that some of that means that you're just saying what's convenient. But it does seem to me what you've experienced in your career is allowing yourself for these positions and ideas to change, because that's exactly been my experience as well. The way you talked about hiring, that's the way I thought about it, which is like, oh, then you do this. No, just the smartest. And that's what really brought me around to this idea that the reason diversity is so important in terms of organizations is so that you get that feedback loop of different points of view.
Absolutely. I mean, there's pretty strong research that there's an ideal number of people to put in a room if you're trying to come up with kind of creative, innovative thinking, and it's seven. And that of those seven, two of the people should know nothing about the subject. And part of that is because those are the people most likely to ask the most challenging questions, because they are completely unencumbered by being experts.
Yeah.
There's a book called Rookie Smarts that I think is quite good. It's a mix, as many books like that are, between research and anecdote. But its premise, as you would guess from its title, is how often the best decisions are made by people who have not been in a position the longest time.
Right.
And I look back at when I took over Playboy and it was in a lot of trouble. And of course, in hindsight, I think, what was I thinking? And in part, it was because I just really had no idea all that I didn't know.
Thank God.
But in part, that lack of being weighted down by being certain about what should be done was the key to reinventing the company.
Yeah.
And I do think that that challenge is the most critical challenge for all organizations. You know, the guys that get the answer to the question of what business are we in right are the Netflixes. The guys that get the answer to the very same question wrong are the Blockbusters.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty much that straightforward.
No, that's cut and dry. And I mean, you know, I experienced this certainly too, because I ran Second City for around 20 years. And I totally now look back and go, man, those last couple of years were definitely, while I'm very proud of the work I did, and we did some really innovative work with the Hubbard Street Dance and Lyric Opera and all that, I certainly know that I knew my stuff too well. I knew the brand almost too well and needed other powerful voices, voices that could change to come in and make changes. And I think that that's happening now. It's fantastic. And there was an author recently, and I think Adam Grant was writing about him or a thinker, where the suggestion was you should bring in someone who doesn't share your culture into your business. And my first thought was that's terrible. Culture is so important. But then as I sort of read into this, I'm like, no, that makes it, because if your culture is strong and you believe in it, it can withstand someone coming in and challenging it.
Sure.
And that's I think that's hard for especially successful companies to reinvent themselves.
That's why I think innovation rarely occurs in big successful companies.
Yeah.
It's almost always the scrappy startup, because the big successful companies are, for perfectly legitimate reasons, quite confident in the way they've always done things.
Mm-hmm.
And to think about doing things very differently, to think about doing things that would be actually competitive with what they're doing, that's a hard transition to make.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking about very macro things, but I was reading a quote from you, and it's a micro thing, but I think it's really smart. You said, and this is talking about someone asking for a raise. All right. And you wrote, the real question is, what have you done to help my company, my division, my department be successful? You need to understand what those drivers are, because they can change over time. Your company may move from a growth mode to a cost control phase or into an expansion period. So you need to understand that your boss is not wondering what can be done to make Jane happy. Your boss is wondering what Jane can do to make him or her successful.
It's true.
It's so radical, this idea of you know, you don't deserve the raise, but if you go to the person and go, hey, I'm going to make you $3, can I have one? That makes perfect sense to a boss.
I've seen it over and over again that people who are good employees, but they don't grasp that basic concept. So I go out of my way to try and say it to people to hopefully get them to start thinking that way, because I think the default mode for people is to say, hey, I really deserve this. I worked hard.
Yeah.
And that is simply not the conversation that is productive to have. And
no.
I try and say that. And I say, look, I ran a company where I don't think you could find anyone that worked with me, or very few, let's hedge my bets, but not very many people who worked with me who wouldn't have very good things to say about the culture that I built and my leadership style. So that would be considered a company that was empathetic, that was nurturing, that, you know, cared about its people, all those things. And at the end of the day, it's still not about, you know, what you think you deserve, Kelly. It's just not.
No. And I don't know that certainly was not something that I was ever taught and didn't seem common. And when I read it, I'm like, this makes perfect sense. It's, you know, that exactly what, you know, and because I do think, and this is something that we talk a lot about Second City with audiences, the audiences want you to succeed. Bosses want their employees to succeed,
sure.
and they want them to make money for the most part. There's no problem there. But it's framed wrong. The conversation gets framed wrong.
Right.
And then when you're in the deserve mode, right, no one does great work when they're in deserve mode.
Well put.
So, yeah. All right. So we don't have much time, but I do want to talk to you a little bit about feedback, because this is a big area for Second City, right? We create our content in a feedback loop, and improvisation, because it's this area that exists between audience and performer, gives you real-time feedback. And you've talked about the need for 360 feedback. And here's something we all... Who enjoys performance reviews?
No one.
Like either party, right? Giving,
right.
Receiving, zero.
It's painful.
It is the worst. And I know this because I was so bad at giving it and taking it, frankly. Everyone takes it personally, both sides. So this idea of getting rid of that, instead moving to a model where feedback is ongoing, but in a way that is empowering and powerful and smart, seems like the right move. And this is something you agree with?
I do. Yeah. I do. I think we're going to have to reinvent that.
Yeah.
Traditional structure of the annual performance review.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, first of all, to the conversation we were just having about the need to know what are the metrics that drive success at any one moment.
Yep.
The velocity is too fast to say, well, once every 12 months will be sufficient to give you feedback.
Thanks for that note I should have had 11 months ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And secondly, if you take it out of that kind of moment of you're standing in the dock waiting for the jury to come back in and make it a more regular interactive exchange, it's much more likely to be more impactful, less threatening, more effective, all of the above. Because I think one of the things from what I understand about improvisational theater that's really similar to what's important in being successful in leadership generally is understanding that effective communication is less about your ability to put into words your ideas right. and more about your ability to hear the other person's ideas.
Active listening.
Usually people think of communication skills as their presentational skills. And those totally. Are very important. I actually pitch certain skills that I would say everyone should try and get as good at as they can.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is negotiating. One mm-hmm. of them is speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But the critical, more than half the loop of effective building ideas and consensus around moving forward is the not even just listening, but the hearing part. And I think one of the things about improvisation is you have to be in the moment. You have to be hearing. And you have to hear in a way in which you can build on what
right.
someone else did. I did some structured ideation with a guru in that field many years ago who had a great expression of what you shouldn't do that often the smartest people do. And he called it heat-seeking missiles.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what it is,
totally
right? You're sitting in a room and mm-hmm. someone raises their hand and they offer an idea around whatever is being discussed. And the very first thing that happens is someone else says, well, that won't work.
Right.
And then they try and identify the fatal flaw of the idea.
Yeah.
And the truth is that any idea, like any moment in improvisation, you know, there's probably some stuff that's wobbly about it. And
totally.
There's probably a gem in there. And your job as the colleague on the stage or the colleague in that room is to find the gem in it and build on that.
Yeah, yes and it. Yeah, the no is killer of creativity. It's interesting because I've also been thinking about, you know, what can the arts teach business with regard to this feedback? And one of the ones that I thought was great, and this is something I've used on my kids because mm-hmm. my wife and I are both theater people. Here's one. Take the note. So in theater, right?
Very good.
Right.
Yep.
You don't have to agree with the note. You don't have to even do the note. You just take it. You say, thank you. Thank you for the note. And to me, it's like, because when you fight the note, all right, now you're into a cycle. Now you've stopped productivity now. And taking the note, again, allows everyone to sort of incorporate it in. It might make more sense later. It might not make any sense at all. Doesn't matter. Because half the time, I think more than half the time, business leaders, when they're giving notes, are basically saying, you know, here's my idea for us getting better. You have a better idea. Please use it.
Right.
Take the note.
Right. Well, and it goes back to what we've been talking about this whole time, which is the critical importance of diversity of opinion.
Yeah.
And the willingness and ability to hear other points of view and use them to continue to constantly evolve your own point of view and your own ideas, as opposed to thinking that your role is to simply sell your ideas.
Yeah, and that's as apt in life as it is in business.
Yeah.
All right, so I can't. These half hours go too quickly. I could sit and talk to you forever. You're so smart. One of the things we like to end the broadcast with is, you know, and you've already given me like 100, so, you know, you might have already spent that. But what's a yes and moment in your life? When was a time that you would normally say no, and instead you said yes and? You stepped out there with a risk. It seems to me you did a lot of that already.
Well, certainly when I thought that I could step in when Playboy was in serious financial trouble in the early 80s and I was 29 years old without even an MBA, would certainly qualify for that.
Yeah, I think
say.
So. Yes.
That would be a WTF moment, actually.
Right.
But I try pretty often to push myself to do exactly that. I've just gone on the advisory board of an international agricultural company, and I know very little about agriculture. But I think the issue of, you know, how are we going to feed the planet? I think the issue of water. I think all of these are big issues, and I would like to learn more about them. And I think that there are things that I know that I can give to them. So while I spent time deliberating and learning about what would be expected in order to be sure that I was confident I could help,
mm-hmm.
I still thought, It would be much more interesting to say yes than to say no.
Thank you for coming to Yes And.
Thank you. Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
This is Second City Works, getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.